Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Melinda Mogheri. I am a professor of neurology at the University of Copenhagen, a consultant neurologist at the Danish Multiple Sclerosis Center, and the director of the Danish Multiple Sclerosis Registry. This month's topic is about multiple sclerosis. And in today's episode, we'll talk about the Epstein-Barr virus. Is Epstein-Barr virus the key player in multiple sclerosis pathogenesis? My guest today is Professor Nikolaos Grigoriadis. He is a professor of neurology at the Aristoteles University of Thessaloniki and head professor of neurology at the department of AHEPA University Hospital, the MS Center, and also of the Laboratory of Experimental Neurology and Neuroimmunology. He is also affiliated researcher at the Institute of Applied Bioscience, Center for Research and Technology in Hellas. His field of interest are neuroimmunology, MS, experimental models of autoimmune diseases, neurodegeneration, immunomodulation, and cell therapies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. So, we heard about Epstein-Barr as an important risk factor, and it has been a hot topic for the last few years. Can you start explaining what the Epstein-Barr virus is and how it commonly affects people?
First of all, Melinda, allow me to say how much honored and happy I am discussing these topics together with you. And I'll go straight for the sake of time, going straight to the point. Well, first of all, EBV is an ubiquitous human lymphotropic herpes virus, establishing lifelong infection in more than 90% of adults worldwide. Despite its typically subclinical persistence, EBV is consistently detected in numerous cancers, including nasopharyngeal carcinoma, subtypes of Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphomas, other natural killer and T-cell lymphomas, leiomyosarcomas, and others. Of course, the most well-known infectious disease, which is mainly due to EBV, is the so-called infectious mononucleosis. And increasingly, it is appreciated that EBV is also a major risk factor for several autoimmune disorders, notably multiple sclerosis. And just very briefly, to say that EBV transmission typically occurs via sharing of infected saliva. Nearly all of those who are EBV seropositive shed virus into their saliva and are capable of infecting EBV-naive individuals. However, primary EBV infection is also possible via hematopoietic cell transplantation, solid organ transplantation, and blood transfusion. And then EBV is capable of infected epithelial cells, B cells as well, natural killer and T cells. And interestingly, first it infects the epithelial cells, then it goes to the nearby naive B cells and infects B cells and turns them into active B blasts. And then EBV activates its growth program, thus turning these B blasts into resting memory B cells. These are some fundamental, let's say, knowledge we have about EBV, and we also definitely need to take them into consideration when, if we are aiming to consider EBV as an important factor in triggering multiple sclerosis.
And what is the evidence that suggests this link between EBV and multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, you came right to the point. Well, of course, some of the evidence of EBV for EBV involvement in MS includes almost 100% of MS patients are showing past EBV infection and association with infectious mononucleosis, which is the acute EBV infection. The higher titers of EBV antibodies associated with an increased risk of MS development and an overall altered immune response to EBV found in peripheral blood and the CNS of MS patients. Thus, EBV seropositivity in virtually all individuals with MS indicates that the infection is a prerequisite for the development of MS. However, the seroprevalence of EBV in the general population is also high, thus suggesting that additional factors are important for the in the etiopathogenesis of MS. So there is ongoing research, of course, trying to clarify whether EBV causes neuroinflammation via autoimmunity or antiviral immunity, and if the interaction of EBV with genetic susceptibility to MS can explain why an ubiquitous virus promotes immune dysfunction in susceptible individuals.
So what you are saying, no EBV, no MS. So it's a necessary factor. Or what would you say? Is there any controversies or challenges in this link?
Just let me add, Melinda, something else in this message we have already sent. I think what we need to take into serious consideration in this story is the factor of age, the age factor. And I'm going to explain right away what I mean. As indicated by migration studies and the association between MS and infectious mononucleosis, the age and exposure to environmental factors such as viral infections are probably important for their potential role in MS development. Therefore, it is important the age at which an individual becomes seropositive for EBV. EBV infection during adolescence, though not earlier, seems to be related to MS. On the other hand, and this is something really new and important, recent studies indicate that human herpesvirus 6A infection is also associated with an increased risk of developing MS. Latently EBV-infected B cells appear susceptible to co-infection with HHV6A, thus resulting in an increased expression of EBV antigens. This suggests a mechanistic link between the viruses in MS etiopathogenesis. I don't know whether all these may give an emphasis to what we have just said, that EBV is an absolute necessity. Yes, but under conditions. An interaction between EBV and HHV6A has already been suggested as a causal factor in MS etiopathogenesis through reactivation of latent EBV in the CNS by HHV6A infection. In conclusion, we may say that hypothetically, infection with EBV in adolescence or later could be sufficient to cause MS in individuals with genetic susceptibility or other risk factors. Conversely, MS following EBV infection in early childhood could depend on EBV reactivation by HHV6A co-infection. While HHV6A primarily infects T cells, the virus has also been observed to infect B cells if these are already latently infected with EBV. Such co-infection leads to an increased expression of antigens of EBV and could be the hypothetical link between EBV infection and early childhood or later development of MS.
Thank you. It's very interesting, this mechanism and pathway that could trigger or even exacerbate MS. But if we now see that EBV is confirmed as a key factor, if evidence gets there, how does this influence the development of new treatments?
Well, I think we should... First of all, this is a very nice question. I mean, I don't need to say that it is a very nice question. Why? Because for the time being, we have almost 18 to 20 drugs in our armamentarium for MS, right? So there is evidence, and this is something really interesting, that all licensed MS disease-modifying therapies target EBV. And there is a compelling case for testing other anti-EBV strategies as potential treatments for MS. On the other hand, we need to define how do effective MS treatments, for example, anti-CD20, cladribine, CD52 depletion, affect EBV-positive cells, EBV infection cycle, the frequency of EBV-positive cells, and EBV loads. And of course, does deficient cytotoxic T lymphocyte control in MS lead to EBV reactivation and increased EBV antibody responses and CNS inflammation? Anyway, active EBV infection via latent lytic infection cycling within the central nervous system or peripherally may drive MS disease activity. This supports testing small molecule anti-EBV agents targeting both latent and lytic infection, central nervous system penetrant B-cell therapies, and EBV-targeted immunotherapies in MS. Immunotherapies may include also EBV-specific cytotoxic or chimeric antigen receptor T-cells, therapeutic EBV vaccines, and immune reconstitution therapies to boost endogenous EBV-targeted cytotoxic T-cell responses. In conclusion, we may say, yes, we have some indication about the anti-EBV action of the currently available DMTs, but still, if we focus EBV and we think EBV is the key really factor, then of course we need to identify other drugs which will go straight and almost exclusively against EBV.
Thank you. So now we touch the treatment. How about, are there any preventive measures that could be considered if EBV is going to be established as a major contributor for MS?
Avoid kissing each other. Well, I'm kidding.
But that's actually in Danish, you call the mononucleosis as kissing disease.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying avoid kissing each other. But this is against humanity, against human life, against human identity. I think, Melinda, we still need to get more and more knowledge about the particular lore or role of EBV. And I don't know whether, of course, in the future, somebody may claim that vaccination, anti-EBV vaccines might be helpful, but we need to wait for a couple of decades to see whether indeed these anti-EBV vaccination had any impact on the MS prevalence. I think we still need to identify more and more pathways interfering and mechanisms interfering in this EBV-related story. And I'm afraid I have nothing in mind to suggest to people about the measures they need to take, simply because we have this strong evidence that EBV may trigger MS.
Thank you. And I think it's very important that we don't only focus on EBV, but also on other risk factors. So can we touch other common risk factors? Can you just tell a bit about it?
Well, I think this is important, and it's more realistic to talk about measures we should take against other factors which might be involved, environmental factors, because we cannot, of course, change our genetic background. But what we can do is to make changes in environmental factors such as lifestyling. I mean, avoid smoking. We know smoking is a very, very crucial risk factor, not only for developing MS, but also for the outcome and long-term outcome for multiple sclerosis. Diet and body weight is also very, very important. And there is much evidence so far that, for example, aerobic exercise may have a very important impact in MS, because we know that aerobic exercise has very well-defined immunomodulatory effects in the human body. And, of course, vitamin D supplementation is also seems to be very, very important. But what I consider a very interesting, Melinda, in these stories is that all these factors are related somehow to one another. I mean, if you take them all together, within one, frame or whatever you may call it, we see how much they may be related to one another. For example, for vitamin D, it has been found that vitamin D may modulate peripheral immune cell transcriptome and induction of anti-inflammatory gene expression. But what impressed me the most was a recent evidence suggesting that gut microbiome located in the interface of the intestinal lumen and epithelia, where dietary vitamin D is absorbed, works synergistically with this vitamin to modulate the immune system. It's a very good example how all these factors we have identified as important environmental factors, among them, of course, the microbiome. You see how they correlate to one another, or they collaborate to one another. And of course, if we take good measures for each one of them separately, then we may probably give the best options to our body for all these factors to collaborate in a very effective and, of course, beneficial way for our body, and in the case of MS, for a better outcome in the long term for this disease.
I think it's interesting, the vitamin D. Now you live in a country where it's a lot of sunlight. I live in the north. What do you still recommend for your patient vitamin D supplementation? I used to say it's not enough. You also have to go out in the sun, but it's much more difficult here.
The problem, Melinda, is that exposure to sun has other risks. And of course, whenever we go to the beach, we put all these creams which protect us from the sun and radioactivity, whatever you may call it. So finally, probably the amount of sun we need in our skin to convert provitamin D to vitamin D might still be not enough. So the only way to increase our vitamin D in our body is supplementation. And it's the easiest way to make it, I mean. Otherwise, I can hardly suggest people to expose themselves in the sun for hours or for, I don't know, because what I'm afraid of the skin cancer, of course, you know, and we always suggest our children, our friends, our patients to put on the body these anti, how you call it, I don't know, these creams.
Yes, which protect, yes, and the sun protection.
Yeah, so finally, what is the result? I really don't know. I mean, there should be a study taking blood from all of us, putting these creams, and then see the levels of vitamin D in our body. But I don't know.
I totally agree. It became more difficult to have outdoor activity, even though outdoor activity has been shown to reduce the risk of MS. But it's, there is a lot with climate. So I'm sure you also have a lot of questions for your patient that I also have, particularly when I give the diagnosis of MS. What can they do when they heard there is a genetic factor and environmental factor? What can they do for their children to reduce the risk of MS? What do you used to say about?
Well, Melinda, I think since MS is not a disease which is related to one single gene or any mutation. As far as I remember, more than 230 genes related somehow to MS. Of course, the most important is the HLA type class 2 gene. So for your genes, you can do nothing. What you can do is to adopt hygiene and lifestyle. And what I'm also saying to my patients is you do not need to do something really specific. For example, as you need to give specific instructions to diabetic patients, what you need to do is to follow all the rules of hygienic, of healthy lifestyle, which is valid for all of us. I mean, don't smoke, make exercise, have a Mediterranean diet, because Mediterranean diet is considered an largely anti-inflammatory diet, or avoid salt consumption, or be happy, do things, be activated somehow. I mean, these are what we can do as human beings, and these are the things we need to take into to have in mind. This is what I suggest to my patients. And of course, what I say to patients, I used to say, is that MS is not an hereditary, genetically hereditary disease. there may be some vulnerability or susceptibility to autoimmune, let's say, generally speaking, disorders, but the disease itself is not transferred to the next, to your children or whatever. Of course, on the other hand, we have the so-called familial cases where one twins, which one has MS, the other one, again, you see, the possibility that the other twin, even monozygotic twin, may get MS is, as far as I remember, about 30%. So the rest of is the 70%. So do whatever you can for the 70% and let the 30% be there, because realistically speaking, we can do actually nothing on the basis of genetic background.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I try to wrap it up in one sentence, and then you can add some. So Epstein-Barr virus is important. It's a lot of evidence. There is a link with MS. However, there is, beside hygiene, it's no way today to prevent it. And but risk factors are very complex. We can do what we can do to live healthy, and let's hope research reveals a more complex interaction. So what would you add to this as a take-home message?
The take-home message is that there are things to do right now. I mean, things are not, like, for MS, are not the same as they used to be a couple of years ago, and of course some decades ago. We know a lot of things, and we know what to do. And of course, there is the ongoing research aiming to provide better and better treatment for people with multiple sclerosis. And it is really very promising, the fact that there is an ongoing research all over the world about this disease. And what we need to do is to take advantage of the currently available knowledge and try to keep ourselves, to keep our body, to keep ourselves in an as better as possible condition. Because what I used to say to my patients, do this. Why? Because let's say, if ever this miraculous drug will come in our life, the miraculous drug you are waiting for, it would be easier for you to take the advantage of such a miraculous treatment if your condition is in a very good shape, is in a very good position, a very good level, than being in more deteriorating conditions, and improve your overall condition thereafter with this miraculous drug. But it is encouraging and it is very promising, and we are all happy, I mean, both the doctors and the patients, that we already have good drugs in our hand, Melinda. And what we need to do is to take into consideration other cofactors in the overall management of the disease. It's not only the DMTs. It's not only the anti-EBV drug, I don't know which will come out, because we need to trigger the plasticity of the neural, of the nervous system, to overcome all functional deteriorations which appeared throughout the years. These functional deteriorations cannot recover simply via one treatment. So it's an ongoing fight, and it's an ongoing holistic, let's say, approach we need to perform. And in this holistic approach, DMT is only one tool we have in other hands. There are several others that we need to take into consideration for our patients: psychological support, physical support, rehabilitation, and others and others and others.
Thank you so much. Let it be the last word. And thank you for this very interesting conversation. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you very much, Melinda. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, really.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.